their own ships. Some made it. Those who didn't were crushed, torn or broken by Vali's merciless attacks with teeth and hands. Felix took a blow across the shoulders and staggered, but then his opponent was down, felled by Bjarki. He was not berserk. He hadn't had the time to chant his chants and consume his brew of mushrooms, and when he spoke, Felix recognized what he said for sense.
"We have to take one of their boats. Leave him here. He is berserk like I've never seen, and will harm us as much as the Danes."
Bjarki was no fool, and realized that a common enemy could make for strange friends. He pointed to the ship where Bragi lay. Felix nodded and jumped across. He went to Bragi. The wound at his neck was terrible, and his eyes were dim. He was reaching around, searching for something. The wolfman instinctively knew what to do. He had spent his earliest years with berserks, after all. He picked up a fallen spear and pressed it into the warrior's good hand. Bragi's fingers curled around it, and he drew Felix to him. His voice was hardly audible, and Felix had to crane down to hear it.
"I taught him many things," he said, "but I never taught him that."
Bragi began to laugh, and then stopped. Felix touched the old man's face. He had died as the men of his people would have wanted to, thought Felix, with a weapon in his hand and a joke on his lips. Only a few of the Danes remained on the boat, and the fight had gone out of them. Seeing the berserk and the remains of his crew climbing across towards them, they rushed back the other way to join what was left of their comrades on the far boat. Only Vali remained between the two groups on the middle ship. The Danes knew they were facing a monster rather than a man, and had already started cutting the ropes they had lashed to Bjarki's ship at the start of the encounter. On the oarless ship, red with blood, surrounded by bodies, Vali was suddenly still, looking about him as if slightly puzzled. A pair of eyes appeared above the rim of one of the barrels. Someone was still in there, Felix realized.
"Now or never, Felix Libor!" shouted Bjarki.
The merchant stood in the barrel, looking at Vali. He trembled as he stared at the prince. Even from 20 paces away, Felix could see him shaking. Felix looked towards Felix's ship, his movements very slow, as if he feared he might draw attention to himself. Then, with a very surprising turn of speed, he levered himself out of the barrel, ran to the rail of the boat, and rolled over to join the wolfman and the berserk, flattening himself to the bottom of the boat as if he was still in the middle of an arrow storm. Bjarki gave a snort of contempt, but Felix was minded to throw the merchant into the water. Luckily for Veles, the wolfman had other things to think about.
"Can we take the prince with us?" Felix asked Bjarki.
Busy cutting ropes, the big man shook his head.
"He'll still be berserk. We'll follow the current and try to keep him in sight." "And if we lose him?"
Bjarki shrugged.
"We'll pick him up easy enough if we let ourselves drift. If I stay tied to him, I'll have a mutiny on my hands. He's bewitched, and the men won't stand for it."
The fog came over them again, the taunts of Bjarki's crew following the Danes as they disappeared into it. Vali was only a shadow on the corpse boat. The one last rope still connected it to Felix's ship. The rope was cut, and the boats began to move apart. Felix looked at the body of Bragi. Then he turned to Bjarki. He pointed to the old warrior's corpse.
"Tell tales of him," he said,
and then jumped to join his brother as the fog bank swallowed them. Chapter 37 The Hunters. It had been 3 days since Vali had woken, and he felt very strange indeed. He was uncommonly energetic, hardly slept, felt stronger, and had no urge to eat at all. The scents of the night were enthralling to him, and he would sit under the stars breathing in the many odours of the boat, while Felek chewed dried fish from the Dane's provisions. The days seemed alive with sensation. The sun on the water was a field of diamonds, the sky a limitless and entrancing blue, and the wind, when it came, brought a bounty of scents in a thousand varieties he had never noticed before. Beach tar and wet stone, bird droppings, stranded fish, each one containing its own notes, its fascinating signature. When the skies bloated with cloud, he could smell the rain coming in, and sense which way the wind would turn. None of this seemed strange to him, or rather, he was aware of his heightened perceptions as something new, but they didn't feel wrong or unusual. He felt more comfortable with his new senses than he had with his old ones. He thought of Bragi. Sometimes he could think of nothing else. Had he killed him, as Felek had said? The wolfman had called him battle-blind, but would not explain further. Dali felt so distant from his old self that it almost seemed possible. No, the wolfman had got it wrong. Felek had mistaken what he had seen. The mess of battle had confused him. Then, in a rising sea, his eyes confirmed what his nose had told him. Land, a strip of rusty red cliffs against the iron black of the ocean. He took the rudder, saved from the sideswipe of the pirate ship by the curve of the hull, and tried to turn landward. It was frustrating work. The current was pulling across the shore, and the ship responded sluggishly when it responded at all. Felek was no use, slumped in his usual position, sat with his head between his legs, staring at his feet. But they were getting closer. The coast was unpromising, with few beaches and fierce cliffs making a landing very tricky at best. He steered, allowed the current to take them, steered again, let go again. Then they were racing under dirty brown cliffs a boat's length away. The sea was getting higher, the wind whipping up about them. Ali didn't think he would have much of a chance if the boat struck the rocks. He looked at Felek. The wolfman would have none. The boat was pushed into the cliff by a wave, crashed into the rock face, and bounced off, spinning round. Ali let go of the rudder. Nothing to do now but hope. They were speeding backwards, the cliffs racing past so near. Vali could have touched them. The boat wouldn't survive another such impact, he knew. Again they turned, and again, and then another crunch, and the boat was still. The ship had come to rest on a sandbank. It was no more than a couple of boat's lengths to a narrow beach. Felek stood up. "I will swim," he said. "I know you can't, even if you try," said Vali. He picked up a spear, a bow, and a sword from the bottom of the boat. He was feeling very peculiar. One instant his head was thick, as if he was drunk. The next it had a sharpness he had never known. "Get some provisions. If we're lucky, you'll be able to wade to shore." The wolfman did as he was bid, and Vali stepped uncertainly into the water. It only came up to his thighs. He began to wade with the wolfman watching him. He made it easily. The sea was chest deep at most. Felek followed. Vali was surprised to see how hesitant he was. Could someone so fierce in battle really be afraid of wet feet? They were on a small beach beneath a long broken cliff of that reddish rock. Vali said nothing, just made his way towards it. The cliffs were tall but uneven and climbable, and they found their way to the top quite easily, Felek pausing to take some birds' eggs. The view was immense. They had reached a spot overlooking a green land of birch forests falling towards long fjords and a wide grassy plain stretching to distant mountains that rose like black dragons on the horizon. Vali breathed in. He smelled smoke on the wind, and something else. Cooking meat. He held his hand to his forehead and squinted into the distance. There, beyond the barrier of a fjord, over a short hill in the grassland, a plume of grey reached up, curving in the wind. It was a fire.
"What is this land?" said Felig.
"I don't know," said Vali, "but I intend to ask."
The two made their way around the fjord and over to the grassy plain. The fire was 3 days' walk away, but still Vali did not feel hungry. He thought of the blood he had vomited. It was possible something was wrong with him, though he didn't feel at all ill. In fact, he felt uncommonly well, like that point after a drink of beer when you first feel its effects. Your tongue seems looser, your wit quicker, your body more able, and yet a dullness stalks you, as if your reason and discernment are fading away. Reindeer herds were moving in the distance, he could tell, and thunder coming in on the wind. Felig gathered herbs to dress his wound, but it was clear to Vali the wolfman was not well. He was sweating heavily and visibly hot, with a sweetness to his breath that Vali could smell 10 paces from him. The prince was irritated to have to stop to let him rest, irritated beyond reasonableness, he recognized, but he wanted to press on. In fact, he was angry with Felig, and that anger seemed caught up in how he had been feeling since he had woken on the boat. Why couldn't he leave him? He just couldn't. He felt utterly bound to Felig, like the rain was bound to the land. He had tried to kill him at Hemming's court, and told himself the intervention of the boy had saved Felig's life. But in reality, his own will had failed. As his senses changed and his thoughts distorted, Vali realized why he had not been able to stab him. The wolfman felt like kin. The thought was heavy inside him, but he couldn't acknowledge its weight any more than he could deny it. A storm swept over them hard and cold, but Vali did not pause. The fire was invisible now, but he could still scent its wet embers through the downpour. There was another smell, too. The sour smack of the wolfman's wound. Vali tried to ignore what it was doing to him, but a bubbling growl seemed to fill his mind, and he struggled against acknowledging it for what it was. A call for blood. Blood. The taste and the scent of it had not left him since the ship, and he could not shake its savour. They found the remains of a camp as the sun was beginning to dip behind a large black peak, spreading a span of rays across the sky. There was no one around, but the earth was flattened, and there were the cold ashes of a fire and the smell of animal skins on the grass where people had slept.
"They went inland," said Felig.
Vali nodded. He knew.
"Then follow," he said.
He spat. For a day he had been salivating heavily. The prince seemed possessed to the wolfman. Felig looked at him with fear in his eyes, and he did as he said. The storm had gone and the sun was rising by the time they came upon the reindeer hunters. A new fire had led them there, seductive in its smell of cooking meat. A single family was gathered around 2 squat, conical tents of birch poles and reindeer skins. The tents were open at the top where the sticks met, and in one of them was the small fire that had drawn Vali and Felig in. Of more immediate concern, however, were the 2 men who challenged them a bowshot from the camp. A bowshot was an appropriate measure of distance, because both of the hunters had strange short bows in their hands. Arrows were stuck in the ground in front of them, not knocked, but available for easy access. Vali felt his blood rising in his veins, ready for the fight,
and tried to tell himself there was no need. Yet his focus had shifted, it seemed. His first response was to think of murder. He felt a hand at his side, and his sword was drawn without him touching it. Felix tossed the sword towards the bowmen and sat down on the ground. Vali exchanged a glance with him. The wolfman was wounded, but Vali had only ever seen him respond to newcomers with seething anger before. Now he acted as Vali himself would have wanted to act, had he been in more control of his mind. Vali remembered the raid on the monastery. Hadn't he made a gesture like that once? He tried to recall that thought, to drop an anchor, to hold him still in the tide of animosity that was engulfing him. The hunters, who wore dark blue coats trimmed with red and gold bands, gave a friendly wave and walked towards the brothers. They were an interesting people, thought Vali, with dark hair and blue eyes like his own. They all exchanged smiles, and the hunters said something in a strange language and sat down in front of them. Vali didn't understand a word. The wolfman was opening his pack with weak fingers. He offered the hunters wine in a skin, which they drank from gratefully. It was the same skin Vali had tried. He had thought it was bad, but the hunters seemed to like it well enough. One of them gestured towards Felix's wound, and then to the camp. Vali stood to follow them, but realized that Felix could not get up. He had spent the last of his energy on the overnight trek. The prince had never seen the wolfman weak before. He knew what had happened. His wound had turned. There wasn't long for him now. Vali forced himself to think. To be the boy who had grown up around Forkbeard's farms, the young man who had loved Adisla and had vowed to die for her. That dirty mire water was in him, though, and he struggled to frame his thoughts. It came to him that he should help Felix to his feet. He crouched, put the wolfman's arm around his shoulders, and got him up. The human gesture seemed to restore Vali, and his head cleared some more. These were whale people, or their kin from the interior of the country who lived from reindeer. Hemming had said that Harik intended to exchange Adisla for his son. Perhaps they would know where or who this domen was that Bodvar Bjarki had spoken of. At the camp, the men made signs for the brothers to sit inside one of the tents. A woman was in there, holding a young child. She looked at them with wary eyes, but pointed to some furs for Felix to lie on. Vali lowered the wolfman to the ground, and then went outside. The interior of the tent was unbearably stuffy. He needed to be under the sun. Felix lay breathing heavily on the deerskins. The pace Vali had demanded had nearly killed him. The wolfman was convinced that some sort of sorcery had taken the prince, but he was still determined to follow him. Something had moved in Felix when he had spoken to Adisla, and he was set on following his impulse to find her until the end. He breathed in the aromas of the tent, cooking and curds of goat's milk, reindeer hide, and the birch fire. Felix found it all immensely comforting, and recalled evenings sitting in the dark with his brothers and sisters, and listening to stories of adventure and glory. He had had no idea he was different then, marked for a special destiny among the wolves. Felix had not wanted to be inside for years, but now he was content. It was Vali who sat in the open, head bowed and looking at his feet. A man came in. He was smaller than the others, and wearing a hat of four corners, like a parcel of cloth folded back on top. He nodded and smiled a greeting, sat down, and put a hand on the wolf pelt Felix wore. The wolfman felt no threat, and allowed him to pull it aside. The man examined the wound. He shook his head, and ran his fingers lightly across it. Then he turned and said something to the woman. She brought Felix some stew in a bowl, and he ate it gratefully.
"Ruochta,"
said the man to Felix. He pointed at him and made a gesture of lying down on his side and turning up his eyes. Felix realized he was telling him he was going to die. Felix had never feared death. When he was with his family, he had been told it was glorious. When he was with Kvet Ulf, he had seen it as simply a happening, a transformation, a different kind of day among other days. He thought he would be happy to die in the little tent, with its domestic smells, among the kindness of these strangers, although the peace of that place, the company of the children and the women, the smiles of the man in the four-pointed hat, made him want to live. He wanted this for himself, he thought. The words, "I am a wolf," came to him again, but what wolf ever thought that? He was separate from his forest brothers, for all that he had been raised to be like them. The man in the hat got up and left. Outside, stew was brought to Vali. He ate a little and drank some of the fermented milk drink he was offered. He could hardly stomach it, and accepted only out of politeness. He smiled at the woman who had brought him the stew, but the gesture was for him, not her. These rituals of etiquette and manners seemed vitally important to him now. He needed a link to the everyday, the human, he thought, to keep him from... What? He didn't know, but he was afraid of the feeling within him, halfway between nausea and elation. It was something that seemed ready to evict him from his own head. The prince knew he was losing something valuable to him. Everything felt different. He had thought before that the sensation was a bit like being drunk, and that impression was stronger now. There was a feeling of freedom, like when the wine first takes effect. There was the knowledge that he was entering a different sort of consciousness. There was even some fear, but this was accompanied by an odd delight, an inner snigger that said, "Go on, give in to it. Step away from yourself and change." He did not know where he was going, nor what had happened to him, but instinctively he knew he had to fight it. Mad thoughts jostled in his head. "I am becoming not myself, but how can that be? Myself is what I am. Therefore, I am leaving myself to become myself. Myself is more than one thing. I am uncontinuous and broken. I am..." He struggled to find a word to sum up how he felt. And then it came to him. Hungry. Yes, he was hungry. But not for anything that the pot could provide. He looked inside the tent and realized that Felix would not be coming with him. He wanted to leave right now, to find Adisla. The love he bore her seemed to take on even more importance. It was like a light seen through rain by a lost traveller, something to guide him to safety. He saw her face as he'd seen it for the last time when she'd kissed him goodbye. Fearful, anxious, but full of love for him. Vali waved to the man in the four-pointed hat. He willed his unwieldy brain to concentrate on what he needed to do, using Adisla as the focus for his thoughts. The man came and stood next to him. Without a shared language, they struggled to communicate.
"Harik's son," said Vali.
He scratched in the dirt a picture of a ship, then mimed it being wrecked by smashing his fist into his hand. He drew a crown and mimed snatching it.
"Domen," he said. "Where is Domen?"
The man smiled at him and made a calming gesture with his hands. Then he turned, ruffled the hair of one of the children, kissed the woman who had brought the stew, and set off across the plain towards the distant mountains. Vali felt helpless. He sat outside the tent with the reindeer family watching him, saying nothing. He began to lose concentration, to just exist beneath the changing light, the moving clouds. Barley didn't know how long he had been sitting there when he felt a hand on his shoulder.
No tribute.
The man spoke Norse, however badly. The man was back, and with someone else just like himself, in a dark wool tunic and four-pointed hat. Beside them was a roped reindeer. The nervousness of the beast seemed to flood over Vali. He could taste its fear. Instead of a bow, the newcomer had a broad, shallow drum in his hands. Vali started. It was just like the one he'd seen in his dream on the boat, where he'd glimpsed Adisla surrounded by those odd, masked figures. This one, though, wasn't decorated with that crooked little rune that had tumbled from the skins of the drums in the vision, but with scenes of hunting and fishing.
No tribute,
the man said it again.
No tribute, said Vali. I'm looking for a person, not furs or gold.
The man smiled, and Vali saw that he had two extra teeth in his upper jaw. He knew this was how the whale people chose their holy men, by physical peculiarities like withered limbs or odd-coloured eyes. Velis Libor had told him as much. The thought of the merchant's name filled Vali with nausea.
Domen?
The holy man looked at him blankly.
Domen! Drums!
Vali pointed at the drum.
Domen!
Fakoi, said the holy man.
Domen!
The holy man shook his head and gestured inside the tent, pointing at Felix. He scratched a sort of rough circle and a wavy line in the dirt. Vali didn't understand. The man took up a rock. He scratched out a little hollow in the earth, put the rock in it, and poured some water from a container around the rock.
Fakoi,
he said, pointing at the rock. Then he howled, splashed at the water, and mimed beating the drum. Vali suddenly saw it. He was showing him an island full of wolves where the drum was beaten.
Domen,
said Vali, pointing at the rock.
Ah! Dormen,
said the man, and Vali realized he had got the pronunciation wrong.
Yes, Domen.
The man nodded.
Yap miyaka, he said.
Then he pointed at the tent, shook the flap that covered its entrance, said slowly,
Hell, goddess, fight,
and snarled with a grabbing gesture. Vali pointed about him.
Which way?
The holy man gestured east, waving his arms several times to indicate that it was a long way. Vali didn't wait. He got to his feet immediately and strode off in that direction, but the man called after him in his incomprehensible language. The prince turned, and the man pointed at him, then at himself, then east again.
You will take me?
Said Vali. He echoed the man's gestures. The holy man gave a slow nod and disappeared inside the tent. Chapter 38 What is Within? The sun set, which it had not since they had left the south. Autumn was coming, and soon behind it, winter. Felix could almost taste the ice on the air. He had a freezing fever, and his body shook with cold. They brought him out under the deep stars and laid him next to a fire. He smelled the chill on the grass, but the flames were fragrant and kept him warm. A little girl stroked his hair, and her mother brought him blankets. A small platform made from the stump of an uprooted tree was set down at his side. A stone was placed on it, along with a stick carved into the likeness of a man. Cheese and meat were laid out. Spruce twigs were put there too. The reindeer was tethered close by. The reindeer man came to Feylig. He touched his wound. Pain shot through Feylig, and there was blood on the man's hands. The man stood and walked to the reindeer, smeared the blood across its face and back. Something was cooking on a pot, but Feylig knew it was not food. It had a bitter aroma to it that he didn't like at all. Vali was there too, sitting looking out to the east, talking to nobody, and with no one trying to talk to him. One of the hunters took a cup from the pot and put it to Feylig's lips. He swallowed, and as he did, he recognized the taste. It was very similar to the brew that Kved Ulf had fed him during their rituals, the drink that unlocked the doorway to his wolf nature. The reindeer man drank himself and passed the cup around. He went to Vali and offered it to him, but Vali was blank and distant. The reindeer man was insistent and pushed the cup to the prince's lips. Vali suddenly seemed to awake from his trance, took it, and drained it. Then the drumming began, and the reindeer man intoned a harsh but beautiful chant. A hunter accompanied him on a small bone flute, and Feylig lost himself in the music. The drumming went on and on, as the chanting rose and fell like the sea, or like the voices of his wolf brothers in the hills. The skies were wide and beautiful, and Feylig saw bright streaks flashing across them. He saw the people around him, caring for him, and he thought them very like his own family. He saw the face of his mother looking down at him, telling him she was sorry to have sent him away, and he could come home now. The reindeer man was there, but he wasn't the reindeer man. He was a reindeer, and his antlers were made of stars. There was another presence, too. The stars seemed to have taken shape and fallen to earth in the form of a man who rode a horse of stars and carried a bow of stars which held an arrow that was a comet.
Ruochta! Ruochta! Ruochta!
The other hunter had the reindeer to the ground, though it brayed in protest. Then it screamed. There was the sound of sawing. Something was put into Feylig's hands. A pair of antlers. He held the antlers out, how the reindeer man showed him. The chanting went on and on. He saw the man of stars raise his bow, but it was not pointing at him. He knew the figure for what it was, a god of death. And it had come for him, but the hunters had tricked it. The comet arrow flashed towards the reindeer. There was a final hideous bray from the animal, and then it was quiet. Feylig trembled. The women and children came to lie close to him, warming the chill of the fever away. But the chant went on. The man of stars had not gone. He was fitting another arrow to his bow, though none of the hunters seemed to notice. Vali listened hard to the drumming. It was in him and around him, and did not beat alone. From behind the mountains where the fat moon dipped, another rhythm answered it. The taste of the holy man's brew filled him up, and he thought he might vomit, but then he felt the drums commanding his own heartbeat. Someone was speaking to him from a long way away. The sound of the drums seemed to have a physical form, like a rope winding over the mountains to twine around him and pull him in. And he heard a voice from far away, in that odd foreign language, rasping out its chant.
Yap miyaka! Yap miyaka! Yap miyaka!
Vali knew that the name was chanted in hate, not invocation. Something wanted Yap miyaka dead, and he was caught up in that wish. The brew was percolating through his mind, stripping away his reluctance to yield to the hunger that was calling to him. He looked at his hands. They were beautiful, and he spent a long time studying them. It had never occurred to him before just how long his fingers were, how pointed, more like talons than anything human. His teeth felt uncomfortable, too big for his mouth. He couldn't stop licking them. There was that taste. There it was, iron and salt, and a depthless beauty that held all the pull of roasting meat to a hungry man. The blood, the deep and alluring scent of blood was in him.
"I am strong,"
he said it out loud. The drum was faster now, the voices harsher.
"Yap me yakka! Yap me yakka! Yap me yakka!"
And then the rhythm seemed to take a mad tumble, fast as a rockfall. She was there, he knew, the thing they had been calling to. He saw a child with a woman's face, gaunt and lined. She was covered in gold, and precious gems stuck to her skin as if she were some shining snake. She was watching as the drumbeat curled around him to draw him on. The beat was telling him something. He had to go on a long journey. She was there, Adisla, the one he had come to find. His final thought, when it came, did not arrive from outside. It was not a stream of symbols seeping into his mind with the rhythm of the drums, though that is what the rhythm seemed to intend. Neither did it come from the grotesque girl-woman who looked on from the firelight. The magic around him was just a spark to a fire, igniting something far bigger than itself. The thought came from himself, from within. He spoke to give it form.
"I must fortify myself," said Vali.
He stood. He felt very long and sinuous, more like something made of shadow than flesh. Things were moving around him. Vali reached out to catch them, to break them, to feed on them. He felt a blow and brushed it away. He heard screams, but was lost to the taste of the meat. He fed deeply, feeling the stress of his prey seep into him with a gorgeous tingle.
"I am fortified," he said.
There were some broken things on the ground, things that had been useful to him, things that had been going to help him, direct him, and show him the way. He didn't need them any more. He knew where he was going. He was going towards the drumming.
Chapter 39. The Nature of Magic. Adisla had now been on the island for months, and to her surprise had been treated very well. It wouldn't have been her first choice of a home, a long flat rock rising out of a turbulent and cold sea, but her fear that she was to be some stinking whaleman's bed slave had not been realized. The people were kind. They brought her meat and bitter bread, berries and salted cheese, even gave her a rough beer to drink. She was also allowed to sleep alone, in a low, conical tent which was open at the top to allow the smoke of a fire to escape. Although the tent was tiny, the little old woman detailed to care for her was skilled at building the fire, and Adisla found it less smoky than the longhouse. Her arrival had been terrifying. The whole rock had seemed to swarm with men, 30 or 40 of them all in animal masks, but not like the pelt that Feleg wore. These were skillfully constructed from supple twigs, shaped into the likeness of a bear or wolf, a bird, reindeer or seal, and covered in fur or feathers to terrible, frightening effect. The men drummed and sang and peered at her closely, but they didn't touch or harm her. Harik had been given instructions on where he might find his son, and been told that a scout was watching from the mainland, ready to ride a reindeer hard to the young man's slaughter if he tried anything. The whaleman had dealt with Norsemen before, and were careful to extract oaths that they would not be harmed once Harik's son was released.
For all his talk of violence, the king looked pleased to leave. He had a warrior's distaste for magic, and wanted to collect his son, and then put as much distance between himself and the island as possible. Most of the whale men soon left the rock, including the sorcerer who had travelled with her. But Adisla remained with the old woman to care for her, and in the silent company of a man called Noaidi. He was small, even for a whale man, dark-haired, with very blue eyes, and he habitually wore a wolf mask as he moved about the rock. At nights, he usually went down towards the sea on the open ocean side, and sat at the mouth of a huge cave, playing his drum and singing in a way that seemed to echo the sounds of the wind. Noaidi said nothing to her for days, and then, when she had been there about a week, she realized she had not actually tried to speak to him. One night, when he didn't go off to chant, Adisla saw him remove his wolf mask and go to his tent. She went across and knelt at the entrance. He was lying on some furs, and the little fire had been fed until the inside of the tent was as hot as a smithy. In the firelight, without his mask, he was a shocking sight. He must have been around 25, but was terribly drawn, his cheeks hollow and his eyes red. He hardly seemed to notice her at first, and she saw he was trembling. "Why am I here?" Noaidi looked at her.
"I am sorry," he said.
He clearly had to think hard to remember the words, and spoke Norse in a thick accent that reminded Adisla more of a cat than a man.
"You speak our language.
I know your people too well."
He smiled a brief smile, and she could see that he was very ill indeed.
"Then why am I here?"
The man thought for a moment. He coughed and took a swallow of water from a cup. Then he gestured her into the tiny tent. She crawled in and sat down very near to the blazing fire. It was uncomfortable, but she wanted to question her captor. The sorcerer seemed, if anything, rather cold. He smiled again, though, and seemed pleased to be able to talk to someone, although he was breathless, and his words were halting and slow.
"I will not lie to you. In our visions we saw a spirit that we foresaw would do us great harm. Yap-me-yaka, the death goddess, lady of dark places and the dark places of the mind. The prophecy was clear. She would destroy us. So we looked for magic to protect ourselves. First, we struck at her. It did not work. A year ago, the spirit met one of our men in the underworld. The underworld. In here."
He tapped his head.
"She killed him. Like that."
He snatched with his hand at the air, as if crushing a fly.
"But we saw that the spirit was making powerful magic. Magic that she began years ago, before she even knew she was beginning it. Now we seek to turn that magic against her. So we looked for you."
"Why me?"
"We saw in here,"
again he tapped his head,
"that the way to turn this magic was through you. Her weapon will be our weapon. We need powerful magic to do this. There is another spirit, a wolf god. We can set him against her if we can bring him here. He will come looking for you."
He was shaking quite badly now.
"And what happens when this spirit arrives?" "Through you," he said, "he grows teeth."
"Do spirits have teeth?" The man swallowed some more water.
Spirits and gods take many forms.
They are here,
he tapped the ground.
And they are everywhere. You are just here.
And you?
Everywhere. Sometimes.
How?
The man tapped the ground again.
This is solid when this,
he tapped his head,
is solid. When this,
his head,
becomes as water, then this,
the ground,
can flow away. When it does, I fight the goddess. Our minds tangle and we battle each other.
How?
Through resolve and persistence. I steal her magic. We are winning.
It doesn't seem to do you much good, said Adisla. You look fit to die.
The things I win from her.
He seemed to be having more difficulty framing his words.
I would not take them unless it was necessary.
Does she harm you in this struggle?
Not so very much. She seems weak or distracted. I cannot tell. To do what we need to do, to make the thing that will kill her, we have to steal her power from her. The damage is not in the taking of it, but in the having. There are things of great power. Runes, symbols older than the gods. I rip them up by their roots and take them from the death goddess and plant them in my mind. Sustaining them, it seems, is what costs.
And these runes will help you call your wolf.
I think so. I cannot tell. Sometimes I can sense him, sometimes not. Sometimes he is a man, sometimes a wolf. I see his face, and I know he will come. I am sure of that.
How are you sure?
Many ways.
Be careful the wolf doesn't use his teeth on you, said Adisla.
Noedi nodded.
I have gone to him in dreams and called him. When he arrives, I will bind him. He will use his teeth where he is meant to, when he grows them.
Adisla continued to question Noedi. She discovered that Noedi was not his name, but rather a title given to sorcerers in that region. His real name was Lieai Bolmai, which Adisla found very difficult to say. He had become a magician because, as a child, he had shown the gift of prophecy.
All my life, he said, I have seen this day coming. All my life, I knew that Yapmeyaka would strike at me.
The fire in the tent burned on, and the two of them fell into silence. Adisla thought Lieai Bolmai seemed a gentle man, and couldn't believe he was planning anything bad for her. After a long time, she asked the question that was concerning her most.
Am I a sacrifice?
I don't know.
She looked into his eyes and saw nothing to reassure her.
Am I to suffer?
No,
he said, but looked down and would not meet her gaze.
Magic is like speaking. You will know what you want to say, but when you speak, not the exact words you are going to use. His mind, he who is coming, must open. It must be shocked into opening. Then the spirit will come to earth fully. Perhaps his mind can open without you,
Perhaps not.
Which spirit? The wolf! The wolf who will protect us!
Then he would say no more. After a month, under a sky of slate, men came over from the mainland in boats. They took Adisla to Liai Bolmai's cave in the hollow light of the late day. It was a huge wound in the side of the rock, 3 times as high as a man, and more than 3 times as wide. It was strewn with rubble, and dipped down into blackness. The sorcerers lined up at its mouth, peering into the dark through their animal masks.
"Down,"
said Liai Bolmai to Adisla. He was not friendly now, but serious. He was wearing his wolf mask, so his face was invisible, but she could see that under his red robes he had become terribly thin. His voice was quiet, like a fever sufferer's, and she saw sweat at his neck, despite the cold of the day.
"For what?"
"This is where the spirits are," he said. "Here they can come through. Here the wolf comes to earth."
"I will not go."
Liai Bolmai swayed slightly, as if her refusal was causing him pain.
"Until he comes, you are safer here."
"I will not go."
He took off his mask and looked at her.
"Please,"
he said with gentle eyes.
"It is easier if you agree."
One of the other Noaides came to his side and supported him. Liai Bolmai was trembling, standing as stiff as a tree in his battle to stay on his feet. A man who was willing to put himself through such an ordeal was unlikely to tolerate much more resistance. Adisla thought of what she had done to her mother, of the grief that had dogged her every day since the raid, and her apparently remote chance of ever returning to a normal life. Then she went down with the Noaides. Remarkably, Liai Bolmai came with her. At a point where the passage narrowed and dropped so much that she had to bend her head to continue, it fell away into a shaft. There was a flat boulder leaning against the wall, a great slab. Underneath it were some wooden wedges. Adisla looked at it and shivered. They were going to seal her in. Liai Bolmai caught her look.
"Only a precaution," he said. "If he is human, as we expect him to be, there will be no need for it."
Adisla wondered what he meant, but decided she would rather not know the answer and said nothing more. A Noaidi showed her how to wrap a rope around herself in order to climb down. There was no light as she descended, just darkness and the smell of wet rocks. She went down about the height of 5 men and found herself on an uneven floor. Liai Bolmai was lowered, limp as a hanged man. He untied himself and sat panting for a while. Then he gently pushed her forward through the dark. She felt her way, a hand on the ceiling, another on the wall, her feet testing for further drops. It seemed they went a long way forward. Then she felt the passage open out, and Liai Bolmai told her to stop. He struck a flint, set some tinder burning, and lit a whale oil lamp. A wolf's head loomed at her from the dark, its teeth bared and its eyes angry. She screamed, but quickly realized it was only a carving, though very disquieting. The sickly light showed the cave around her smeared with runes, a tiny stream of water filtering into a pool at the back. He pushed the flint and tinder into her hands, set down a pack beside her, and took off his thick reindeer coat.
"For your comfort," he said.
"What happens here?" said Adisla.
"Magic is like speaking," said Liai Bolmai. "Let us see what we are required to say."
"What am I waiting for?"
You will see in good time.
How much time? How long must I spend in here?
Not long, I think. It is hard to tell. We are working the magic as best we can. He is not easy to find sometimes. Today? Many days. I don't know.
Noises drifted down from above, drumming and chanting. Liai Bolmai gave Adisla a sad smile. Then he turned and was swallowed by the dark. Adisla heard the sound of the Noaides heaving him up, and then the slither of the other rope as it was pulled in. She was alone, in the blackness and the damp. Chapter 40 Wolf Hunt. Felek woke. Around him were the voices of ravens. His fever had gone, and his wound was healing. He sat up and looked around. For a heartbeat, he didn't understand what he was seeing. Where there had been a family, a fire, and welcoming smiles, now there was only ruin. Of course, he had been among corpses before, and corpses he had made, too, but never anything like this blood swamp. The bodies had been devastated. Men were unrecognizable from women, children from animals. How long had he lain there? He looked at the bodies. They were beginning to rot. The scene did not repulse Felek, or make him wretch, as it might have someone who had not spent half his life as a wolf, but it did make him shake. Since he had been looking for the girl, humanity had come back to him. Suffering had started to mean something. He felt the years that had been denied to these children, the tendernesses and the joys. He thought again of his own mother, the break from his family that had felt like an amputation. Felek pondered what to do. He had no idea what these people's customs were, or how they preferred their dead to be treated. The birds were there, and he knew that the wolves would come down when the darkness held for long enough to conceal them. It seemed a good way to him. So he just set their stone back on the stump that served for an altar, put the drum beside it, and left. It was not difficult to track Vali. The ground was wet, though not sodden, and the prince's footprints were clearly visible at points, blood on the grass at others. Felek thought of what he had seen on the boat, the tempest-made flesh that the prince had become, thought of the sight of him among the dead bodies feeding. The wolfman, for all the killing he had wrought with hands and teeth, had never eaten human flesh. He never had the need in the winter, when animals were weak and easy prey, nor the opportunity in the summer, when most travellers went by sea. And besides, Kveldulf had not taught him to eat men. The shapeshifter knew the diseases that could emerge from cannibalism and the madness that it brings. Felek was sure that Vali had attacked the reindeer hunters. Whatever enchantment the prince was under had consumed him, and yet Felek felt he had no choice but to follow. Vali was looking for Adisla, which meant that Felek was bound to him. When Felek freed the girl and she married him, he would ask her to release him from his vow, and he would kill Vali. Felek followed Vali's trail east for days, relying on scent, tracks, and hunter's intuition. In a pass through some black mountains, he came across a cave. Vali had stayed there for days, he could tell. The prince had not been his normal fastidious self, and on the ground at the mouth of the cave was human shit. Felek saw that it was sticky and cloying, and it smelled of blood. It confirmed what he already feared. He didn't want to sleep there, so he followed Vali's trail across the path. As he continued east, it became colder and the skies more grey than blue. The vegetation turned to scrub, a stunted tundra of dwarf trees and shrubs that seemed to cringe from the wind. Shelter became difficult to find. Feleg ate what he had taken from the ship. He hadn't been able to bring himself